Hi, welcome to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. In episode 13, season 1, I spoke with Ellen Waterman, a flute player, scholar, and improviser. She was appointed to the inaugural Helman Kallman Chair for Music in Canada at Carleton University in 2019, where she's developing a research program committed to investigating issues of diversity and decolonization of music in Canada through scholarship, research creation, and experiential learning. I find Ellen really inspiring, and we discussed her career path and perspectives, both as a creative improviser with flute and voice, and as a scholar. In the end, she created a solo improv, and in a separate bonus episode, you can hear our improv together. All of these podcast episodes are also available in video format, and the link is in the description. Hi, Ellen Waterman.
Hi, nice to be here.
So glad you could join me. So you are a flutist, a free improviser, a scholar. I'd love to start a little bit with your story, how you got to where you are now.
So first of all, it's lovely to get to have this conversation with you, Leah, and to get to play some improvised music with you too. I didn't begin as an improviser. I began as a classical musician. You know, I have a very standard Bachelor of Music in Performance kind of background. But I was always interested in contemporary music and chose to do a graduate degree in performance at UC San Diego, which just happens to be a school that foregrounds composition and contemporary performance. So I spent a couple of years just really getting my hands and mouth and body on all the kind of extended techniques that one uses with the flute. And there are, you know, dozens of them.
Actually, if you could show us, that would be great. So some people are listening to this in podcast format and they won't see what you're doing.
I can describe that. So, you know, the flute is classically a melodic instrument. And like all classical musicians and vocalists, we spend years developing a beautiful, pure kind of sound, right? So the orchestral sound would be something along the lines of, you know, that kind of thing. But in contemporary music, from the very beginning of the 20th century, there's been a lot of work done with the flute. It's a mechanical instrument, so you can get very good percussive effects. All I'm doing is clicking the keys, and with the flute, the more holes that are closed on the tube, the lower the pitch. The fewer holes that are closed, effectively, that shortens the tube, and the higher the pitch. So the other thing that I can change is if I cover the mouth hole, that also drops the pitch down by about a seventh. And you can do this stuff on the fly with your tongue as well, because we articulate with our tongues. And we do that in a lot of different ways. So we have at our disposal, you know, ta kinds of sounds, double tonguing, tuka kind of sounds, triple tonguing, tuka da tuka da tuka da. These are standard kinds of techniques. But I use a lot of different little syllables with my tonguing. So if I just use ch sounds or ha sounds, or if I slap my lip with my tongue instead of tonguing behind my teeth, I can get a lot of different articulations in the sound. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other thing you can do with the flute very easily, more easily than with an instrument that has a blown instrument where you actually have the mechanism in your mouth, because in the flute you're blowing across the mouth hole, it's easy to use your voice. Mm-hmm. Right. So whether that's the, you know, famous Ian Anderson kind of sound from what was that famous band in the 70s? You know, he's this kind of famous Aqualung is the famous piece. This kind of famous rock star flutist who sang at the same time. Whether you're just doing that, you know, it sounds really fun, and it makes the flute go from that kind of sweet, pure sound to something really aggressive and nice to do. A great flutist who uses that technique is the jazz flutist Nicole Mitchell, who has a very, very high voice and super good control over it. So she can spatialize very widely between what the voice is doing and what the flute is doing. So I don't have to play the same thing that I sing, of course. Mm-hmm. So I could be... you can do them independently of one another, right? Very easily. It's the easiest extended technique to do on the flute. More difficult, of course, are multiphonics, where you can play split the air so that you're the air column, so that you're playing two notes at once. An easy one to do is from a third register D. And you can play with it so that you can do it as a stable dyad, or you can flip it back and forth, and it has to do with the position of your tongue in your mouth, and also with the airstream, just the direction that you're putting the airstream. So these are things that show up in lots of repertoire, including contemporary orchestral repertoire for the flute. Flutter tonguing is another one, you know, just doing an old R sound and playing. And they've become, we say extended techniques, but arguably in the 21st century, these are just technique, mm-hmm. right? But what I've done is to really develop a practice as an improviser who, going beyond those kind of learned techniques and using them in scored performance, developing as an improviser has really been about making that my own vocabulary. So if I want to use my voice with my flute, I don't think about a targeted technique. I just play and listen to what both the flute and the voice are doing at the same time. I have... I really don't anymore recognize much of a difference between the two. It's just like the voice and the flute are the same instrument. Yeah. So I had the good fortune at UCSD to arrive at the same time as George Lewis, who's an African-American trombonist, jazz musician, scholar, computer musician. He's a big innovator there. And he was really instrumental for a lot of us at that moment in the early 90s in saying two things that were really important for me. One, that improvisation should be a part of a musician's practice. Not by saying improvisation is a superior aesthetic or anything like that, but just that one should own the creativity, right? Own your creative agency as a player, and becoming comfortable improvising was a good strategy for that. He talks a lot about code switching. So musicians who have the ability to sort of switch genres or switch different styles of playing, and to be able to do that within an improvisation gives you a lot of a grammar and a kind of vocabulary for interacting with lots of different kinds of people musically. Yeah. So after I did my master's degree, I stayed at UCSD to do a doctorate, and they had this at the time a terrific program that allowed me to develop as a scholar as well as a flutist. So my PhD is in critical studies and experimental practice. And it allowed me to do conducting, to work on some of the more operatic works of Karlheinz Stockhausen, to play a lot of the new complexity repertoire, Brian Ferneyhough and others, that was very, you know, kind of in vogue in the 90s. And also to work as an improviser and to write about all of these things. So that was a huge, huge benefit to me.
And your first teaching job, actually, before we go there, can you talk about Pauline Oliveros and her influence on your life?
Yes, thank you for that. So I met Pauline at UCSD, actually. I had a very memorable meeting with her. So first of all, Pauline Oliveros, who lived between 1932 and 2016, was an iconic American composer, improviser, philosopher, educator, and really human rights activist. She's very famous for her concept of deep listening, which for her was a practice of listening to everything that was present to hear all the time. And by that she meant listening to very focal kinds of sounds, like focusing on a sound, listening globally to everything all around you and all those different points where sound comes from. You know, the ear can in very finely pinpoint the direction of a sound and how far away it is. And also interior sounds and those sounds in your head and the kind of script that's going through your head all the time. So she was, and memory, she had this great exercise where you listen to the sound of someone that you're close to speaking to you on the phone. So if you try to recall the sound of my mother, for example, who's deceased, and hear the sound of her voice over the phone in my right ear, is that different from listening to that in my left ear? And if you focus and really try to do that, it's extraordinary how precise the color of that sound is and the character of it is. So we have these, she taught me that we have these incredible embodied senses of what sounds are like. And for her, paying really close attention to sound was, and especially through kind of very active, empathetic, reciprocal listening, that was a way not only of building an aesthetics or just sharper tools as a musician, but also a way of becoming a much more responsive person, right? So for her, it was really an ethics of interrelationship with other people. And I had the great good fortune to work with her later on when she was in her mid-70s and I was at the University of Guelph. We both were part of a large international project on improvisation as improvisation community and social practice. And Pauline brought to a research group on improvisation and gender in the body, she brought a project that she had developed of working, developing an instrument, a non-invasive instrument for people with very minimal volunteer mobility. It's called the Adaptive Use Musical Instrument, and a team has now developed it over the last 10 or 15 years. The great thing about the OMI is that, you know, by simply using the camera tracking technology on a laptop or an iPad or an iPhone, you can index a little marker to a part of the body that a person is able to move. An eyelid, a nose, a finger, the breath, you know, the chest. It doesn't have to be very, very much movement. And then the movement the person can make triggers samples. And those can be loops, they can be fun sounds, they can be musical sounds. And it's designed to be super easy. It's a pretty simple instrument, really. So we've worked along with Jesse Stewart here at Carleton University and this large international consortium of people working on it. We worked with Pauline and a number of different schools and agencies for people with disabilities over this long length of time and various people on the technology side who would take the experiences of people with disabilities actually working with the instrument and then use that information, that feedback, to improve the instrument. So the philosophy there I thought was just so fine of thinking of music making as a human right, that everyone should have access to, and turning the ideal of classical music that I've been trained in completely on its head, right? You know that if I try to demonstrate to somebody what you have to do with your left arm to play the violin, that hurts, you know. Like, it's not what I'm saying is it's a stretch, right? For you, I'm sure it feels like a completely natural thing to do, but you had to learn it, right? You had to adapt your body to the instrument. Same with the flute. We don't hold our hands up in this weird way, parallel to our to the floor, the way you do when you hold a flute. The idea of the adaptive use musical instrument was that the instrument should adapt to the user, and that's a very powerful idea.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go to Guelph. That was your first job as a professor, and I know you did some interesting work with improvisation there with students.
Yes, I should say it was my second job. I started at Trent University in cultural.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. But at Guelph, I had the opportunity to work with an ensemble that was initially a for-credit ensemble that the students had started. They called it the 20th Century Music Ensemble, but I arrived in 2002 and seemed like an old thing. That's so 2 years ago. So we renamed it the Contemporary Music Ensemble, dropped any audition requirement, and opened it up to anybody to join. And so every semester I'd have about 25, 30 students, and they ranged from, you know, violinists with their ARCT to a guy who played a plastic, you know, Bubenzvela horn for 4 solid years in the ensemble, to a lot of visual artists who were interested in experimenting, that kind of thing. And we would do project-based work each semester. And that's, I think, where I really developed an improvisation pedagogy.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of pedagogy, how would you work with them?
Right, so we would use a lot of games, draw on exercises that some of them come from theater, some of them would come from comedy, some of them would come from, you know, other improvisers musically. And then what I would very frequently do is just put people together in small groups and let them figure it out. So we would have a project like, let's see, 1 year we worked with a videographer who developed 7-minute films based on scenes from Shakespeare. And the students took the same theme. They didn't see the film, they just took the same theme. And they worked out a sonic improvisation related to that theme. So maybe it's the scene from Hamlet where Ophelia commits suicide or something, you know, dramatic like that. It didn't have to be literal. In fact, it was better if it wasn't literal. We talked a lot about, you know, the getting away from mimesis and instead really, really extrapolating and experimenting with the mood, the feelings, the affect.
Mimesis, I'm not familiar with this word.
Oh, a copying, right? Okay. So instead of trying to do a copycat kind of thing and you know, what does it sound like when Ophelia's body is drifting down the river? You know, sort of, instead of being literal about it, you know, really trying to think of, like, okay, so what is happening in this scene? What is really going on emotionally in this scene? And develop something musical that feels like a good sonic response to that. The videographer Kenny Doran came to the rehearsals and listened to the students and then went away on his own and made the videos. And then we performed them with the students playing and the videos behind the students. So the students were not playing to the video. The visual was a kind of reaction to the sound. And then the audience did this interesting thing, because I think our brains just do this. They created a kind of match between what they were hearing and what they were seeing. So we really tried to work on projects like that were quite interdisciplinary and gave students a kind of defined range. In 7 minutes, you can't go too wrong, right? So you have enough scope to develop something, but not enough rope to end up feeling like you've run out of ideas or what I mean to say.
That's wonderful. Lucky students.
Well, I was lucky. I learned a tremendous amount from them. And I have to say, my most effective pedagogical tool really was leaving the room. Because students or anyone learning to improvise really just need to do it. Right? They just need to be feeling it out and as much as anything, getting to know the people they're playing with. Like, it's a lot about that kind of relationality. And when you feel more comfortable and you get to know someone a little better, you can have a better conversation.
Yeah. And speaking about the earlier part of your career, I know you spent many interesting summers in a big R. Murray Schafer project. If you can speak to that a little bit.
Yes, yeah, for sure. So I worked for about 10 years with Murray Schafer in various parts of his Patria series. This is a series of 12 environmental music theater works that are mainly set in very unusual environments. So a wilderness lake at dawn, or a series of urban environments that a small audience traverses through the middle of the night. And the piece that I worked most closely with him on is the epilogue to the series. It's called "And Wolf Shall Inherit the Moon." And it has been taking place in the Halliburton Forest, which abuts Algonquin Park in Ontario, since 1989. And Schafer, who just turned 88 2 days ago, is no longer active in the project, but a few people still go up to do the project. And in the mid-90s, when I was doing my doctoral thesis on the Wolf Project is its kind of colloquial name, it was at its peak, so there were about 75 people.
Wow.
We would make music and art and dance and theater together over 10 days in four different locations in the forest. And the owner of the forest at that time, Peter Schlieffenbaum, it's a privately owned forest of 50,000 acres or something. It's huge. He would keep motorboats and things away from the activity that we were doing. So we were so fortunate. We had this really amazing, quite accessible and yet pristine feeling, you know, woods to work in. And the project was as much about canoeing and camping and, you know, digging latrines and cooking over a fire as it was about making music and dance and art in a series of kind of daily rituals, really.
And the audience were the participants. There were no extra people.
Absolutely right. So it was professional musicians and dancers and dramaturges and theater folks, but it was also amateurs. Mm-hmm. And people came with their kids. Quite elderly people joined us, so it was intergenerational. Mm-hmm. And very community oriented. That was for me a really important formative experience. Mm-hmm. Making music and art and community in that way. Because if you were a professional musician, you had to meet community musicians where they were, right? And I remember one such musician saying to me one time, you know, the problem with professional musicians is they're never not professional. And what she meant by that was, you know, look, we have to work together. You can't just come in and impose some kind of standard or ideal or whatever that you think is right. You have to make room for everybody to have their say in the way that is authentic to them. So I felt like I learned a tremendous amount from doing that work.
And he wrote a couple of pieces for you in that context. Obad was the morning?
Yes, and a nocturne to play at night. So the way that kind of music would work is that you might be assigned in your camp to get up and play the Obad, the dawn music. And it could be a lot of different things. It might be improvisational, or might be a piece somebody had written, which is the other great thing about the project was people brought their own music to it, although Murray wrote a lot of music for it. But these flute pieces are gorgeous. They're both in the RCM syllabus now. They're really designed for the way the flute carries when you're outdoors, right? Which is not very well, you know. Trumpets and we had an alp horn, a clarinet, really sing in the outdoor environment. The flute's a little wussy. But if you go to the edge of a lake at dawn before the wind has come up and there's mist on the water and you play out over that mist, Then you have the opportunity to play with the dawn chorus, with other kinds of sensory stimuli, like the feeling of the cold air on your face or slightly damp, leaves under your feet. All of this kind of stuff becomes a part of the performance. And the way that Murray writes these kinds of environmental pieces is to leave a lot of space. So the pacing is very much up to the performer. They're not barred. They're very freely written. Because what you have to do is, this goes back to Pauline Oliveros, you have to listen and respond to what's there in the environment. And you don't want to rush over some interesting thing that you're hearing from an animal or something. And you don't need to be too romantic about all of this. As someone pointed out to me once, the chattering of birds when I play is probably not birds going, "Oh, how lovely the flute." It's probably, "You're disturbing me," but the ethos of it is just, again, making music in relation to an environment that is more than human.
Really interesting. And as a scholar, I know you're involved with many, many different things. You've written about the, as you term it, the ecology of music.
Yes. So my work, again, very much influenced by Schaefer and by Oliveros in particular. I've been very interested to think about the whole network of relations or factors in any given performance situation. I guess really it's performance that interests me about music most. And I mean that in the broadest possible sense. So formal performance, informal, accidental, the way of being a musician in the world, how we present ourselves, all of that. So I really developed some ideas about the dynamics of both those interpersonal micro musical moments and the broader set of things that influence them. And you know this very well, like it could be everything from the venue to the time of day to the financial circumstances of a performance to the all the unseen people that make a performance go well or not. That's the people who are stage managing or who are running front of house or showing people to their seats. Things can go very wrong very quickly if those folks are not great. But they're unsung, right? That we don't hear very much about them as being a part of the musical act. This is not unique by any means. Lots of people have Christopher Small famously wrote about music as a verb, musicking, and to include all of these things. But my specific focus has been looking at experimental music performance in Canada in festival contexts. To really take a close look at what's going on stage, but also surrounding it, and what in the broader culture is affecting it. So I've looked at things like the changes in the CBC over time. It used to be before 2007 that the CBC would regularly record full concerts of new music and put them on the air, right?
And when, for people who aren't Canadian, I can just interrupt. It's the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is funded by our federal government.
Right, so it's our public broadcaster and meant to serve everyone, and it reinvents itself every so often. It's an arm's length organization. It's not an arm of government, but it's very prone to whatever is causing the government to give more money or less money, I guess. Same with our big National Funding Council for the Arts, the Canada Council for the Arts, which is another organization I've looked at. So around 2007, the CBC stopped doing this level of recording. By 2012, they had stopped doing much recording at all, except in a couple of cities in Canada. These things had huge impact on the income of artists, the opportunities for them, who a festival could attract, because they, without that funding, they wouldn't be able to bump up the fee they could pay an artist by also having a broadcast. All of these things affect the ecology of the music, right? So I guess I've always just been quite interested to know what's going on when we perform music, both from that embodied listening identity kind of angle and from that broader social.
And at Carleton University, what courses are you teaching?
So I do have a PhD seminar, an MA seminar that I run on the ecology of music and sound. And in that course, we look at a broad set of concerns and different types of theories of ecology. Some of them are from, you know, far-flung fields like feminist science and technology studies, the work of Donna Haraway or Anna Singh. And some of them are really made in Canada, like Murray Schafer's very famous acoustic ecology, or the relatively new interest in something that's being called eco-musicology, which has more to do with a kind of environmental activism through music. So we look at a lot of different bodies of theory and then see how they play out in particular, mainly Canadian examples, because my gig at Carleton is a rather nice one. I'm a research chair in music in Canada. Mm-hmm. So it's the Helmut Kallman Chair for Music in Canada. So this is a nice connection to a really important musicologist and music librarian in Helmut Kallman.
Mm-hmm. So I know you don't lead any ensembles at Carleton, but during the pandemic, you have a special project you're involved with.
Yes, you know, the pandemic, I was talking about this with a graduate student this morning who's working on how we all made music online during the pandemic. I think a lot of people are working on that right now, but this master's student has a very clever way of talking about it. I want to just mention his work. Brendan Kent is his name here, because I think he really hit on something important. He said, at that early moment in the pandemic last summer, when everyone was kind of reeling with enforced social isolation, there was a real rush to go online and try to make music online, even though for most people with domestic internet and the available platforms knew that they weren't going to be able to make synchronized music or perhaps music that even had very good sound, right? But even for organizations that had been working with, it's called networked music, this what we're doing right now, even for people, organizations like NowNet Arts in New York that had been doing this at a very high level for years using, you know, very fast internet connections like Canary or Internet 2 and specialized software, stuff that requires quite a lot of technical know-how. Even for those people, they went to Zoom. They went to the most available, most widely used platforms because the need to be together became more important than holding to a certain aesthetic standard. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing that Brendan's discovered through his research is that, or articulated through his research, is that what happened is that as people kept coming together to play music on a platform like Zoom, Zoom started to improve its technical platform, adding the, you know, advanced music mode and echo cancellation, things like that, the original sound, in response to the needs of musicians. And musicians began to be better at playing together despite latency and despite the kind of loss of sound or grainy sound or interference from a truck outside on the street. You know, we all just sort of got a little bit more used to that. So I have been running a couple of different research projects looking at this, and early in the pandemic at Carleton, we had this need to get our ensembles online for the fall. So we got a little grant together and we led a project where we hired a group of students to be our lab ensemble, and we hired a choral director and jazz band director to be the directors. So we're using our real people with their real crappy internet and their real motley collection of microphones. And we figured out what we needed to do to make them all sound better. So some of that was getting equipment to people. Some of that was just, we all had to learn this thing called Zoom. And we tried a bunch of also other kinds of platforms. And out of it came the students. I kind of got the bug for improvisation, which we were using as a way to deal with the latency. Mm-hmm. I guess it's obvious, but maybe worth saying that, you know, the thing about improvisation is it's very flexible. So it allows you to listen for the delay or play with the delay. And, you know, not everything works. Going one, two, three, four doesn't work together. But a lot of other kinds of ways of overlapping and interacting do work just fine. So I've been playing with that lab ensemble, those students who wanted to keep improvising, all through the last year. And we came up with different ideas of how to use Zoom. So a really fun one was just using the chat function of Zoom to type instructions to the band of what to do. So one person would conduct the band basically through that chat. Another was a student who was able to use her iPad and a graphics program connected to her computer in Zoom to do a graphic score where she could move elements, visual elements of that score in real time. So she could create a little tile for Leia and then move Leia from the accompaniment side of the score to the solo side of the score, for example. So it's kind of an echo of my experience at Guelph. If you just leave students alone to come up with ideas, that's a great way to work. They're just endlessly fertile.
Mm-hmm. And another area of interest for you is the decolonization of the music history syllabus.
Yes, and not just the syllabus. Yeah, and again, I have to say I'm in very, very strong company here. This is, I think we're all so much more aware in the last 5 years since the TRC report came out of the need to recognize the particular structures of our pedagogical programs. And to ask ourselves serious questions about them, right? And in music, we've been a little slower in general, I think, to adopt new ideas than some other fields in the academy. You know, English programs were doing world literatures long before music programs were running world music courses, for example. Now we're at a point where we're saying, okay, yeah, but what do we mean when we say a world music course? You know, where do we put Western music as the norm and then everything else is the world? Are there many ways in which we are, our structures privilege people who come from a socioeconomic status where they can afford to take piano lessons for 10 years in order to get into a music program? And to, you know, these are not questions that have never been asked, but now I think there's a kind of critical mass of people asking them and really having to say, how do we sustain the things we're committed to in music studies? How do we honor the violinist who wants to become a professional orchestral musician and at the same time create a lot more room for a lot more different kinds of musicians to enter the program? There's lots of, you know, talk about an ecological view. There's lots of things pushing at this, right? It's not as though our schools of music in Canada are bursting at the seams with classical musicians, by and large. Recruitment is not so easy in this economic environment to you know, get young people to do a music degree. And also, the job opportunities for musicians are far more various now than they were 50 years ago, right? So to say to a saxophonist, you know, you're really only going to play classical repertoire. Where's the gig right afterwards? Where's the job? At Carleton, we have a fairly diverse program already. There's a lot of different kinds of musician you can be. You can be a singer-songwriter or a heavy metal guitarist or an African drummer. We in fact, use West African drumming as a central part of our ear training curriculum right from the first year. So there's always already been some really interesting stuff. But now we're asking ourselves questions about what does it mean when we audition musicians? Who are we including and who are we excluding? And what does it even, and I'm not saying we're ready to abandon the audition, but we're asking the questions, you know, the standard things in a music program, the jury. you know, that little played exam that a student does at the end of a 13-week semester. So I don't know if you remember doing those, but they're horrible. You know, it's a quasi performance, but in front of of three or four judges who are judging you, no audience, and no immediate feedback. You know, you don't get the applause, or, you know, it's a test. So what are we doing when we situate music in that way, and we judge it according to how somebody did on that day? I don't know the answers to these questions, but I'm very interested in being part of a movement across Canada to really ask the hard questions, and also ask, who are we hiring in our music programs? Who are our students? Who's not in our programs? Who's not even attracted to them because they're not going to find themselves there? And that might be musically, but that might also be around racialization or gender and sexuality. There might be all kinds of barriers for people.
So when you were a teenager starting, you know, playing the flute, did you aspire to be an orchestral flutist? Was that your idea, or a soloist?
Yes, I did. I had a stack of Jean-Pierre Rampal records, and as a, you know, young teenager, I would put them on my record player, my portable record player in my bedroom, and you know, just go to sleep with them on and wake up in the morning with the thing going round and round, thinking that maybe by osmosis I could get that sound. You know, it's what I'm not at all knocking classical music, you know, and that early dream that many students have, it attracted me enormously. And I had also a very good benefit of right after my undergraduate degree, there used to be at the Royal Conservatory of Music in Toronto, there used to be something called the Orchestral Training Program. Mm-hmm. This was a paid gig. You didn't get paid very much, but enough to just barely live. And you did a full concert season, but you had 3 weeks with each conductor. Mm-hmm. So we got to work with, you know, the conductors of the day, like Rafi Armenian. And you learned a lot playing in a chamber orchestra, getting to play that early Beethoven repertoire, the Mozart repertoire, Haydn. That was all really, really great to do. And it taught me that I was in no way suited to be an orchestral player. A very valuable thing to learn before you go and do a dozen auditions, eh? Mm. Yeah, and gave me a tremendous respect for what an orchestral player really has to be good at in order to get that very difficult kind of career path.
Mm-hmm. And in your home life, you have an interesting creative partnership. And I know that in the quarantine period, during the pandemic, you participated in this RPM project.
Yes, yeah. The RPM project is happens in different places in the world, but we discovered it in Newfoundland when we lived there. It's a project where in February, people are invited to make an album. And it's anybody, right? So the whole idea is just an album's worth of recorded music. And then the community gets together, and maybe they're played on community radio, or there's listening parties that people get together and hear them. It's run, the whole shebang, the international shebang, is run by a Newfoundlander now, Elling Lean, who did it in Newfoundland when we were there. Well, during the pandemic in April of 2020, they did a special pandemic version of this. And my husband and I thought, well, we'll form a band. and we became PAMA, which is a play on old family shtick. When we would go bowling with our daughter, we'd be PAMA and DA. So PAMA is our not very elegant name. Michael Waterman, my partner, is a superb improviser. He's a visual and sonic artist who works with collaged sounds, homemade instruments, plays the theremin. So he brings all his interesting sounds to bear on it, and I come with my wishy flute.
And he's been involved for many years with this radio project. Could you talk to that?
Yeah. For the last 25 years or so, Michael has been the linchpin of an ensemble called the Manleshire Carcano. The Manleshire Carcano Radio Hour started at Trent Radio in the late 1980s. where they had given Michael a position of radio artist in residence and allowed him to just kind of develop anything. So he basically formed this group with former art school friends who had now scattered to different cities. And the idea was that they would improvise together on the radio using what they call trailing edge technologies. So broken down cassette tapes or boom boxes or old records, which had not yet come back into vogue then. They didn't start working with CDs until a decade or more later, once CDs stopped being a shiny new technology, right? So the whole idea was just making sounds with whatever was to hand, but found sounds. And at the back in the day, they would use the on-air interview line to perform, right? And now they work on Zoom. So it's undergone a lot of evolutions, and it's been part of every community music radio station where we've lived, except for Ottawa, because the sacred time is Saturday afternoons, and Carleton's radio station has a fantastic reggae program that's about 40 years old. Yeah. So it's not going anywhere. So doing it now on Zoom allows them to have many more people. During the pandemic, it went from regular kind of membership of about four or five people in Montreal, Ottawa, Los Angeles, Berkeley, and Groningen in the Netherlands, to often having 12 or 15 people, because folks had time, right? And they discovered interesting things about Zoom that I don't think I've worked with so much in my own work, and that is the visual aspects of Zoom. You can run video, of course. There's all the backgrounds and the funny little animations and things you can do. They really work with that playfully, with that visual element as well as the sonic element. And and they publish it every week, both on YouTube as a video, and it goes out on air through CHMR, which is the community radio station at Memorial University.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's a continuous improvisational online or you know, networked practice that's been going on for a really long time.
Yeah, and you mentioned the word play, and I think that's a lot of, that is improvisation, is that feeling. And as adults, we often lose a sense of play as we grow up, with, you know, unless you're involved in sports, but you know what I mean, just in your daily life, just to have that.
My goodness, yes. And we, you know, we, this is another thing about being professional musicians, and again, I'm not knocking either the path, the craft, or any of what we all try to work really hard at. And I will also say that great improvisers are very accomplished musicians, right? There is a craft and a real deep learning involved in being able to do that code switching and being able to build very solid formal musical structures in real time. But the thing that we often lose is that notion of play, right? That notion of it does, the stakes are so low, right? The stakes are so low. And yet those of us who have been trained in literate music traditions can feel very scared to improvise, to step away from the score and just make sound. We're so invested in the number of years we worked going, you know, even as I play that note, I think, oh, gee, that doesn't sound super great. You know, I should be practicing more, or, you know, there's too much air around it, or, you know, all that editing we do as classical musicians, and how much of that editing we are taught in the one-on-one lesson format, right? Because what you're getting all the time is that constant sonic check from your teacher, and being taught to listen out from your body and hear the sound, assess it critically, adjust it. These are very fine skills.
Huh? Actually, continue.
No, I just want to finish that by saying, so I went, but my ability to do that should not stop me from reveling in nobody died, right?
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, Ellen, you have your flute in your hand, if you would be willing to do a short improv for us to close this out. That would be amazing.
I'd be happy to do that.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Okay. Yeah, and thank you for your wide-ranging questions. It's fun to get to talk about all the different things one is doing, and I've really enjoyed the rest of your podcasts.
Thank you.
So here's some sounds.
Thank you.
Really influenced by the very loud sound of the moving truck across the street that's making a constant baa pitch.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Season one of this podcast had 20 episodes, and season two continues with a really interesting mix of musicians talking about their lives and careers with perspectives on overcoming challenges, finding inspiration and connection through a life so enriched with music. Please follow this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts to be informed about each new episode.